title Suffering with God, it can be taken many different ways, but probably the most obvious way, we're into the end of the diaries of Eddie Hillison here, just to bring those of you who haven't been here before a little bit up to speed. She begins her diaries in late 1941, and by the summer of 43, she spends most of 1943. 42 she writes, and by the summer, and she's into the collection camp of the Jews who are collected to be deported to Poland. And so the first two-thirds of this book are written before she spent any time in Westerbork. And the last 30 or 40 pages, plus some letters in the back, are after she has spent some time in this camp. She has a little bit of mobility because she's part of the Jewish Council and kind of a staff member, if you will. So she has experienced increasing amounts of fear and seen firsthand some pretty hideous suffering, not extermination, but she spent most of her time in the hospital in Westerbork with very little supplies, but basically where the sick were, and it's really kind of sad. So she has been kind of theoretical in her understanding, but as we began, the quest for the call of the inner life is where she started. It began her journaling and studying, and developed through her journaling and prayer life a stronger and stronger relationship with whom she called God. And more, her outside life is becoming more difficult, and the whole idea of suffering and the suffering she sees happening is confronting her. And so I think the best way to kind of jump into this is to look at page 186. Not all of you have that handout, but for those of you who do, call your attention to it. This is a Sunday morning prayer, it's entitled. Dear God, these are anxious times. Tonight, for the first time, I lay in dark with burning eyes as a scene after scene of human suffering passed before me. I promise you one thing, God, just one very small thing. I shall never burden my today with cares about my tomorrow, although that takes some practice. Each day is sufficient unto itself. That sounds familiar to anybody? Matthew 6. Later on, she quotes Matthew 6. She must have read it, but she felt she had to write it down. One thing is increasingly clear to me, that you cannot help us, that we must help you to help ourselves. That's a pretty strange thing. You cannot help us, we must help you to help ourselves. And that is all we can imagine these days, and also all that really matters, that we safeguard that little piece of you, God, in ourselves, and perhaps in our others as well. Alas, there doesn't seem to be much you yourself can do about our circumstances, about our lives. Neither do I hold you responsible. You cannot help us, but we must help you and defend your dwelling place into us to the last. What do you think she means by there's not much you can do for us? Any guesses? God, little piece of you, you can't help us. Won't, can't. I'm not exactly sure. I think she has a sense of almost fatalism here. That they're at a time in history where the English or the Americans aren't not going to be able to save them. And that God probably isn't going to open the Red Sea here in a historical sense. I get that feeling. But rather than concentrating on the negative, I'd really like to go with the positive, because she's just banging the drum on her big theme again here. making a dwelling place for God within her. As opposed to, there are, it's true, some who even at this late stage are putting their vacuum cleaners and silver forks and spoons in safekeeping instead of guarding you, dear God. And there are those who want to put their bodies in safekeeping, but who are nothing more now than a shelter for a thousand fears and bitter feelings. What a juxtaposition. A dwelling place for God versus a shelter for a thousand fears. And people are putting their vacuum cleaners away and their silver spoons, trying to make that secure, and she's suggesting, what do you have to make secure? Room for God. Very spiritual versus material. Even body. Trying to save their bodies, but the bodies they're trying to save is just a shelter for a thousand fears. Which is absolutely understandable. But she's calling herself and everyone else to say, whoa, there's another way. And they say, I shan't let them get me into their clutches. But they forget that no one is in their clutches who is in your arms. Sure. I'm almost guessing and more here. In an internal kind of sense. I don't know if she believes in the resurrection, but I read that into this, personally. I mean, that's what I do. As long as I'm in God's arms, you know, what can you do to me? What can man do to me? Yes, my brother said, a lot. Yeah. But ultimately, she's making this profession. Then down to the last paragraph. I have strength enough, God, for suffering on a grand scale, but there are many more than 1,000 everyday cares that leap up on me without warning like so many fleas. I scratch away desperately and tell myself. Boy, that's pretty neat. The difference between suffering on a grand scale and 1,000 fleas, what does that mean? Give me some examples in your life or hers. 1,000 little fleas. When am I going to get my laundry done today, now that we can't drain water? Am I going to be too stinky before it comes back? I've heard a rumor it might be 1 o'clock in the morning. I wonder if I'm going to have enough food in my stomach with just this potatoes not to be hungry by supper time. Are these 1,000 little fleas? Have they taken any space in your life today? They really have. In her case, it's just that to the nth. I mean, it's food, it's shelter, it's bathing, it's all those things. And yet she's saying, hey, I find it easier to suffer on a grander scale. And I find myself getting caught up in that. We'll come back to that idea later. But, you know, she makes this profession. You know, this day is taken care of now, the protective walls of a hospitable home. She is home now, still surrounding like a well-worn familiar piece of clothing. There is enough food for today, and the sheets are worn. So don't lest one atom of my strength on petty material cares. Let me use and spend every minute and turn this into a fruitful day. One star and more in the foundation in which to build our so uncertain future. It's almost as if nature is inspired, continuing. The jasmine behind my house has been completely ruined by the rains and storms of the last few days. Its white blossoms are floating about in muddy black pools on the low garage. Boy, this is like cinematography. We're in the last part of her life, and she's been... If you've been here, she loves the jasmine, and she's taken in, and now it's laying in puddles on the ground. And, it's dark. And yet, rather than melancholia, somewhere inside me the jasmine continues to blossom undisturbed, just as profusely and delicately as it ever did. and it spreads its scent around the house in which you dwell, O God. Anything dwelling in me is dwelling in God's house. And that's pretty neat. I tend to think if God's dwelling in me, like, that can be a cause for paranoia. Right? But she's twisted that. What has God's dwelling in her enabled her to do? To see beauty. And not fear, but faith. I shall try to make you at home always. Even I shall be locked up in a narrow cell, and a cloud should drift past my small barred window. Then I shall bring you that cloud, O God, while there is still strength in me to do so. Now, last paragraph after this long prayer. And now I shall venture out upon this day. I shall meet a great many people today, and evil rumors and threats will again assault me like so many enemy soldiers besieging an inviolable fortress. Dum, 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 da-da-dum, da-da-dum, dum. The body they may kill, God's truth abideth still, the kingdom's ours forever. Were they to take our house, good kindreds, or spouse? That's what I wrote in the margin first, that mighty fortress.
I was humming that all day yesterday.
Were you?
Well, yes, I was. And not the one that we normally sing, or at least in our congregation, but the other one with the offbeat.
Oh, bum bum. Yeah, whatever, the syncopated one. And, well, I mean, that house, she's prepared herself for the day. A mighty fortress is our God. And she's found her rest in that, with the God within.
Um, 189. Not that she's a Pollyanna. This is a very beautiful line I just lead in passing here. Middle of the top paragraph. But sometimes I feel as if a layer of ashes were being sprinkled over my heart, as if my face were withering and decaying before my very eyes, and if everything were falling apart in front of me, and my heart were letting everything go. It's not like this is a waltz through the tulips for her. This person in the castle is acquainted with grief. This is not a perpetual smile. But these are brief moments. Then everything falls back into place, my head is clear again, and I can once more bear and stand up to this piece of history, which is ours. For once you have begun to walk with God, you need only keep on walking with Him, and all of life becomes one long stroll.
Why that word? One long stroll. What does stroll mean? Pleasant, as opposed to a march, a campaign, a marathon. I know so many pastors, some won't be named, that are on a marathon. got to get it on with, and gearing up for battle, and a stroll with God, lifelong, without fear. Begin with walking with God and continue to walk with God. And this is a person who's been to the camps and is going back.
If someone else had written this about the Holocaust, we would call it a heresy.
Yeah, what? A heresy.
A heresy. I mean, this is an unthinkable thing to say about the experience that she's witnessing.
If you jump down real quick, many would call me an unrealistic fool if they much have suspected what I feel and think. Even of our own. And in between that, we go too far and fearing for our unhappy bodies, while our forgotten spirit
shrivels up in some corner. We lack an historical sense, forget that even those about to perish are part of history. I hate nobody, I'm not embittered, and once the love of mankind is germinated in you, it will grow without measure. I thought of Romans 8 here, we're like sheep being led to the slaughter all day long. That always bothered me when I read that. But then we get into height or depth, principalities, and you know, nothing's going to separate us from the love of Christ. She says this is a part of history in which I am. One could say she's a mad woman, resigned to it. She should be strangling people, crawling out from under the gates. If you read a little farther, one little boy runs and hides when it's time for his turn to go. You know what they do? They take 50 more that day for the train. 50 more, because one little boy runs, and she asks the question, how's that boy going to feel when he figures it out? That because he ran and hid, that 50 more went on the train to Auschwitz that day. I mean, it's pretty easy to say resist. But she's willing to walk out her part of history here. But not with kind of bravado. I just find that incredible that she could say that. We go now, I think most of you have page 214. We've gone from this kind of her walking from her fortress with God, and now into the needs of others. At the bottom of the page, how great are the needs on page 214? How great are the needs of your creatures on this earth, O God? They sit there talking quietly and quite unsuspecting, and suddenly their need erupts in all its nakedness. Then there they are, bundles of human misery, desperate and unable to face life. And that's when my task begins. It's not enough simply to proclaim you, O God, to commend you to the hearts of others. One must also clear the path towards you in them, O God. And to do that, one has to be a keen judge of the human soul, a trained psychologist. Then she says, I thank you for the gift to read people. Sometimes, next page, 1215, sometimes they seem to me like houses with open doors. I walk in and roam through the passages and rooms, and every house is furnished a little differently, and yet they are all then the same. And every one must be turned into a dwelling dedicated to you, O God. And I promise you, yes, I promise that I shall try to find a dwelling and a refuge for you in as many houses as possible. There are so many empty houses, and I shall prepare them all for you, the most honored lodger. Please forgive this poor metaphor. She doth protect. Does that remind you of today at all? So many empty houses? It does me. I love that image of people as houses. Or T.S. Eliot's The Hollow Man. So many people, at least the suburbs from which I come, you know, have these great castles that are empty. Empty. Because the honored guest does not lodge there. So she sees it's not enough for her to believe. She asked the question, and I... impoverished, empty lines. This is on 230. Excellent question. I'm just going to skip here a little bit, but it's on this subject. Top of 230. You've got that copy somewhere. Very top of the page, second line. Impoverish empty lives. Can they be taught to work on themselves, to find peace in themselves, to to live in productive and confident light despite all these fears and rumors, to know that one can fling oneself down on one knees in the farthest and quietest corner of one's inner life and stay there kneeling until the sky above looks sunny and clear again. Can someone be taught that? I mean, I see this as ministry for myself. Any Christian, to create space, and to use some of the images of Dorothy Vance, this whole lodging, hospitality thing that she has been talking about this week. Can someone be taught to find room for God, and how does that happen? Is that our job as Christians? And can someone be taught this? It really perplexes me, because I think not that I've graduated from making God a dwelling place for me, within me, but she sees this as the answer. If we're gonna backtrack now, and maybe part of the answer is available here.
If I could comment on that?
Yeah, sure, please do.
And as far as suffering goes in my own life, I've certainly had the 1,000 daily fleeting experience, but I've never experienced grand suffering. But I feel like I've seen it, and it's hard having only had the generic, the basic kind of things to say anything to someone who's experienced that other kind of suffering. You know, to teach them anything, I would think, be presumptuous. I mean, how can you speak? I mean, it's interesting to look at someone like Eddie Hilson, who has experienced this kind of suffering, and see the perspective that she has, but I don't know that I could teach that to someone else who's experienced far more suffering than I ever will.
She learned this before she really got into this, though, to make room for God. And we were talking about our first session about, did we kneel when we prayed? And the one woman said, well, yeah, I kneel. I guess I've done it all my life since I was a child. It was semi like, is that okay? And I was going, yeah, I'm glad you do that. I mean, we can prepare ourselves, I think, for grand suffering. By starting the process early on in our life, it's not so bad. Quickly on 222, I want to stop there, and then we're going to get back to this idea. They're constantly debating what they should do about the enemies and this terrible problem, and she's talking to this Kloss fellow. On the top of 222, first paragraph down. All I really wanted to say is this. We have so much work to do on ourselves that we shouldn't even be thinking of hating our so-called enemies. We are hurtful enough to one another as it is. And I don't really know what I mean when I say there are bullies and bad characters among our own people, for no one is really bad deep down. I should have liked to reach out to that man with all his fears. Should have liked to trace the source of his panic to drive him even deeper into himself, and that's the only thing we can do, Klaus, in times like these. Then Klaus says, but what you propose to do takes a long time, and we really don't have all that much time, do we? That's his pragmatic question. Getting into people, getting connected with God, prayer, all this esoteric spiritual stuff, and Klaus says very practically, well, we don't have all that much time. What does she counter? You want something people have been trying to get for the last 2,000 years, and for many more thousand years before, in fact, ever since mankind has existed on Earth. And what do you think the result has been, if I may ask, you say? And I repeat with the same old passion. It's the only thing we can do, Klaus. I see no alternative. Each of us turn inwards and destroy in himself all that he thinks he ought to destroy in others. And remember that every atom of hate we add to this world makes it more inhospitable. Not that she's out, I mean, this is part of the answer to she can't change other people, but by cleansing herself of her own hate, that's what we can do. And that really kind of ends power games to me, when we go to root out the hate in others. And it's been a theme she's been pounding on for a long time. And then he says, but that's nothing but Christianity. My question, is that Christianity? That we do not, we must turn inwards and destroy in ourselves all that he thinks he ought to destroy in others. We got some theological names which we traffic in, we could hang on that. Mm-hmm. I mean, turning in at oneself and cleansing that, rather, yeah.
Whereas, you know, remove the log from your eye before you make a mistake from the other person.
Kind of repentance kind of life. I work on myself, throw myself at God's knees. But that's her theme, big time. And she echoes it more on 229. This, I think, is one of the key passages in the entire book. To my taste, 229. She's back on this theme that we just talked about, the thousand fleas. In Matthew 6:34, she even names the verse. But then in the last end of that paragraph, ultimately, by Russian essay, you see that? Ultimately, we have just one moral duty, colon. That to mean, like, okay, get ready. Eddie Hillison saying on page 229, we got one moral duty. I better, like, listen up. To reclaim large areas of peace in ourselves, more and more peace, and to reflect it towards others. And the more peace there is in us, the more peace there will be also in our troubled world. We have one moral duty, to reclaim large areas of peace within ourselves. Is that our one moral duty? To reclaim large areas of peace. What is someone like who has claimed great areas of peace within themselves? What's the Lord require of us, according to Micah?
Walk humbly with God.
Do justice. Love kindness.
Love kindness. Do justice and walk humbly with God. And what's the greatest commandment? To love the God and to love your neighbor as yourself. What I have done, if I reclaim peace in myself, then I am no longer, I would say, needy, am I? I mean, I'm not after anything from you anymore, if I'm at peace. If I'm at peace, then I don't need to get anything from you.
No conditions on love.
What?
No conditions on love.
Unconditional love is possible. And if I'm at peace within myself, then I'm not thrashing around. In fact, if I'm at peace with myself, I know I'm alive. I've died. Rest in peace. And the life that I now live, I live by the grace of Jesus Christ who lives in me. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. There's a verse that would fit here. The peace which passes understanding. That Christ lives in my heart. I got the love of Jesus. If Jesus is down there, I mean, it sounds like, you know, she's reclaimed all this, but I think if I've got Christ and the peace of God in my heart, then I reflect that love towards others. And the more peace there is in us, the more peace there will be in our troubled world. So she's taking this immediate, terrible problem and putting it on the 2,000-year plan. And I want to see it work tomorrow. I'm going to rewind
to something about this new age and the theme of our summer, a foretaste of the feast to come. Let's see here. Find my note. On page 194, if you've got a book, at the bottom, they are merciless, totally without pity, and we must be all the more merciful ourselves. Oh God, times are too hard for frail people like myself. I know that a new and kinder day will come. I would so much like to live on, if only to express all the love I carry within me. And there is only one way of preparing for the new age, by living it even now in our hearts. So, to me, she's got this foretaste of the feast to come. Live for the new age. There's only one way to live for the new age to come. It's to live it now. Going to take a quick detour to Kierkegaard again, because he's been real helpful to me. When he used the word in this absurdity to him, this is from Fear and Trembling, that which runs counter to human experience and human understanding in general. Here, the absurdity of living simultaneously in the infinite and the finite. And this is what this is about the night of faith. He says this. With infinite resignation, he, that is the night of faith, has drained the cup of life's profound sadness. He knows the bliss of the infinite. He senses the pain of renouncing everything, the dearest things he possesses in the world. And yet, finiteness tastes to him just as good as to the one who never knew anything higher. And yet, the whole earthly form he exhibits is a new creation by virtue of the absurd. He resigned everything infinitely, and then he grasped everything again by virtue of the absurd. He constantly makes the movements of infinity, but he does this with such correctness and assurance that he constantly gets the finite out of it. It's pretty heady stuff, but we're really into paradox here. Surrender, taking the long view, brings the short view. The fact is, Eddie Hillison spent a whole year in the hospital of this camp with children dying and paralyzed girls being carried on pallets to the train to be gassed in Auschwitz. It's just unspeakable stuff. And yet she did it with cheerfulness to the very last day. And you can call her a dreamer, and you can say, she's saying it's going to take 2,000 years. But where she was, she lived very real life. And what informed her was this absurdity that there is a new age, that if we make a dwelling place for God, they can never get us. That by finding peace in my own heart, I'm going to eventually bring peace to the world. And this whole goofy idealism, if you will, that she doesn't even think people can get, would think she would be crazy to even say. That really gets me. She goes on to say what she thinks our problems are, page 230, at the bottom. I seem able to see ever more clearly the gaping chasms which swallow up man's creative powers in joie de vivre. Okay, what's wrong with humankind? There are holes in our minds. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. And man suffers most through his fears of suffering. The body keeps leading the spirit when it should be the other way around. I mean, I believe in insight therapy to a point. And I think she really is
making an intellectual argument here, that a lot of the joy of our life is because we're thinking and about the world and framing the world in such a way that it's wrong. We worry about the body instead of the soul. It's the holes in our mind that swallow up our creative, take our life. And this, it's not suffering, but the idea of suffering, and that's pretty crazy idea, if you think about it. Man suffers most through his fears of suffering.
I think we suffered. I mean, we probably had illnesses and surgeries and dentist appointments. I mean, I don't mean to be ridiculously mundane here, but a lot of time we get all bent about it's going to hurt rather than saying goodbye to people or letting our children go or grow up and how's it going to be when and what if it doesn't work out and oh, come on, we've had that, haven't we? What if this doesn't work out? What if I married the wrong girl? Are we going to make it? Am I going to be able to live with this woman another 30 years? Am I going to suffer? Am I tied down that I'm a father now? I mean, am I going to be able to get through this council meeting?
Sometimes we do a lot of worrying about something that never does happen eventually, and we waste a lot of time worrying about what might happen.
I read the absurd thing that 99% of the things we're afraid are going to happen never do.
You think of these people hiding their vacuum cleaners. You know, that was energy and that was time, and not time that they had a lot of. You know, I'm sure they didn't perceive it that way. We're looking at, you know, in retrospect, but for what? Over and on. You know?
And how far removed from them are we?
I think very far removed.
In what sense?
Well, I think that she had some very practical, very real things to worry about. For her, that much of the suffering may have been beforehand thinking about what was coming, or that may have been the thing that she was trying to avoid. But I don't know if my imagination is that good. You know, I don't honestly know that I spend more time worrying about things that are going to happen but don't. I don't think that space I spend worrying is more acute than actual bad things that happen.
I was thinking more on the line of worrying about vacuum cleaners. Material stuff.
Okay.
Yeah?
I think one of the hardest things is if you're worried about something that involves a choice, if there is no choice, even though you know what you're facing is really onerous, I think you can resign yourself to the fact that you do not control that thing and that you can simply try to find the peace in yourself and face it. And I think most of us have had or know of situations like that. But if it's a question where you have a choice in front of you still, I think that's very painful because there's the potential for making the wrong choice or the potential for chickening out if it's a question of coming up to it toward the end and still having the possibility.
That's a point well taken. We do agonize about our decisions. And that word decision means to cut in half. That's one thing we should know about a decision. The anxiety will be cut in half when we do decide. And I've always been fond of ethics as irony. What often looks like the good choice and the right thing to do isn't. And that maybe when we face the choice, that not that we're frivolous about our choices at all, but that we make them gracefully under that net, not knowing that what's going to happen anyway. If we're agonizing over a choice, certainly isn't clear cut. So
it is really kind of hard to get our lives in America up next to the Holocaust, but I think the themes are there. And then she talks about the idea of suffering here. And maybe ideas about ourselves. We can kind of close this discussion on this at the end of 231. The idea of suffering, which is not the reality, for really suffering is always fruitful and can turn life into a precious thing, must be destroyed. If you destroy the ideas behind which life lies imprisoned as behind bars, then you liberate your true life, its real mainsprings. Then you will have strength to bear real suffering, your own and the world's. Are there ideas which imprison us? Sometimes they're imposed by our own selves and sometimes imposed by others. Like women can't be pastors. It's not in the Bible. That keeps everybody in prison. Right? But I can't do that is an idea I lay on myself sometimes. I'm afraid to meet you or risk this or do that. An idea holds me in prison rather than reality. You got to use your brain, she's saying here. Let's get down to brass tacks and risk, I think. Because it's a matter of energy again for her. How much energy do you have to live this world? She's into that economy. Quickly on 240. She's going to say at the end, she wonders if maybe she should have become a great writer once upon a time. Huh? 12:10:42. A little gem here. My impressions are scattered like glittering stars on the dark velvet of my memory. I really like that. She's got the gift. Even though she's writing philosophy, where'd that come from? It's like a little haiku almost. There is an autobiography in the paragraph above. I think I can bear everything life in these times have in me. And the turmoil becomes too great, I'm completely my wit's end, then I shall have my folded hands and bended knee. A posture that is not handed down from generation to generation with us Jews. I've had to learn it the hard way. It's my most precious inheritance from the man whose name I have almost forgotten, but whose best part has become a constituent. He's talking about Speier, who's died now, by the way. He died. What a strange story it really is, my story, the girl who could not kneel, or its variation, the girl who learned to pray. That is my most intimate gesture, more intimate than even being with a man. After all, one can't pour out the whole of one's love out over a single man, can one? is that true? We have to learn that. We're getting close to the end here of our time. I'd like to just throw out a couple things here and then get into some discussion and reaction to this whole story before we close. Let's see here. Well, let's go to the last Xerox here, 255. This is one of her last letters. September 30th, she'll be put on the train for Auschwitz. And this is August 18th. But she makes this great confession. The first indentation. You have my made me so rich, O God, please let me share out your beauty with open hands. My life has become an uninterrupted dialogue with you, O God, with one great dialogue. Sometimes when I stand in some corner of the camp, my feet planted on your earth, my eyes raised towards your heavens, tears sometimes run down my face, tears of deep emotion and gratitude. Here's someone standing in a concentration camp, tears running down her face, and I'm ready to say, you know, because she's going to die? No. Because of emotion and gratitude. When I lie down in my bed and rest in you, O God, tears of gratitude run down my face, and that is my prayer. I've been terribly tired for several days, but that too will pass. Things come and go in a deeper rhythm, and people must talk to listen to it. It's the most important thing we have to learn in this life. I'm not challenging you, O God. My life is one great dialogue with you. I may never become the great artist I would like to be, but I'm already secure in you, God. Sometimes I try my hand at turning out small profundities and uncertain short stories, but I always end up with just one single world, God, and that says everything there is to need for you and anything more. All my creative powers are transformed in inner dialogues with you. The beat of my heart has grown deeper, more active, and yet more peaceful. And it is as if I were all the time storing up inner riches. She's lost her life to find it. I mean, this artist thing, I mean, she did it, as far as I'm concerned. She did it. And there's scripture that just jumps all over the place to me. Storing up inner riches, what does that remind you of?
Riches of heaven rather than here on earth.
Yeah, where thief and moth could destroy. Storing up treasure in heaven. Now, heaven not being there, but imminently with God. And a life of unceasing prayer. You know, you're fulfilled with that. The uninterrupted dialogue with God is a life of unceasing prayer. You know, if somebody's wondering what that means, the life of unceasing prayer, which Paul reminds us is in Ephesians, I believe, what we're to be about. To me, this is kind of what it might look like to live a life of unceasing prayer. And it's a shame that this has to happen, you know, that this person dies. What a loss. One more quote. I lost it somewhere. I'll see if I can get it here. Page 228, I jumped over something I wanted to call attention to. In 28 September, she's accused of being too cerebral. You live too cerebral a life. It's bad for your health. Your constitution isn't up to it. When I told Jopi about it, he said reflectively, "He's probably right." I worried about it for quite a long time, but then I realized with ever greater certainty he wasn't right. True, I may think too much, sometimes with a demonic and ecstatic intensity. But I refresh myself from day to day at the original source, life itself. And I rest from time to time in prayer. To me, that's a real nice prescription for what she's about here. Her refreshment comes from the people and life around her. And yet, that you have to have rest too. Rest and refreshment, the R&R, are available to her. And I thought that really summed it up neatly. I can't seem to find this last quote here. There are several one-liners here, but I think with only a few minutes to go, I'd like to ask your questions, comments, thoughts, things you might have been thinking about as we've talked, unfinished business with Eddie. To get it going, I started a week ago by saying, there's someone I'd like you to meet. And her name is Eddie Hillison. And it would be my goal that you would like to continue to know her.
Is anybody glad they met her? Are there some left? There were. That was my goal. Because we're not just meeting an idea here. I think we're meeting a person. And
she's a lot easier to believe as an idea at this point. So I want to read the book to really get a feel for the person, to believe that that idea through a person really happened.
She says, if we're going to teach morality, we better become moral ourselves. That's one thing she says. And I think any of us who would, especially pastor types, who would be about teaching, leading, sharing the mysteries, it's much easier to like listen to the ideas in a person who exemplifies the peace themselves. And that's not automatic. Since you can learn some things from people you don't necessarily like or don't have a lot of integrity themselves. We have it. Some of the biography is a bit troubling in this. She read her sexual life is rather loose. And she has simultaneous lovers, and the relationship with her psychiatrist, Spire Spear, really unprofessional. There are some troubling questions in this book about that. And this is by no means a perfect person, but what saint is? I mean, she's well aware of her limitations. Is there anybody got a thought of anything they've learned that they want to maybe take home or move onward with as a result of this? I mean, I got a couple of my own, but anybody else? Anything new or any resolution?
It's just sort of like a little thing I got to take home and sort of play with, but just the place of suffering in life, you know, that it's part of. It's not something to be avoided. Life isn't measured by the amount of suffering you can avoid, or those times don't count, or, you know, whatever. So I don't have an answer to that, but I have a sort of quest.
That's been helpful to me, too. I guess the other thing for me is the whole idea of attending to my inner life is just as important as doing stuff. Being, one of the ways I put it, it's not always if I show up, but who shows up. Who walks into the room is as important as being there. What do I offer to others when I come into their lives? Who shows up? That makes a big difference to me. And if I'm going to have the energy to be involved with a lot of people's lives, which is by definition what I do, then I better. It's important for me to go rest in God, to be prepared for that, not just for everybody's sake. Who fills the minister's cup? You know, well, God does. And I think this meditation, prayer, and journaling is rather foreign to our Lutheran discipline, at least as I've come to know it. It's something I've read in Henry Nouwen and Thomas Merton and others like that, but we don't. That's one thing I'm kind of, my prayer life and meditation life, and maybe even writing a journal, I don't know. That's something I'm looking at. Other things? Questions? Comments? Yeah.
It's been a long time since I read this, and I can't remember. Was she connected in any significant way with a Jewish community in Holland?
Well, she was part of the... She had a job with the Jewish Council as a typist.
In terms of being in a synagogue life, you mean? Or
yeah,
just,
like a spiritual...
No, in terms of being in a worshiping community, no, not that the book seems to illustrate. No. That never seems to come out. But as a member of this Jewish council, having some official status in that sense. The concluding line of the diary, before the letters begin, is, "We should be willing to act as a balm for all wounds."